In the California Road Trip Republic, we believe you take adventure for a ride. Whether coastal cruising, mountain motoring, or redwood roaming, discover beauty around every turn. Your road trip can kick off from anywhere.
Starting route.
But it should always start at visitcalifornia.com. Then buckle up, crank those tunes, and discover why California is the ultimate playground.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun. And that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
This on? Hello?
We're all science people.
Science!
Exactly. Evolution does some pretty funky things.
We can teach kids and they get it.
There's chemistry in here. There's biology in here.
It's in whiskey. It's in ice cream. It's in who you fall in love with.
That's the recipe for success.
We can make the world better for everybody.
Starting now.
Welcome to Science Rules. I'm your host, Bill Nye, and this is the show where science rules. And if you want to be on the show, and I hope you do, please leave us a voicemail at 201-472-0785. That's 201-472-0785, or go to askbillnye.com on your electric internet machine. I am joined once again by science writer, editor, and dear friend, Corey S. Powell. Greetings, Corey.
Greetings and salutations, Bill. Bill, you know, there are a lot of fun ways that people try to communicate science. I hope this show is one of them. But one of my personal favorites is the comic XKCD. Used to be, actually, you still see old yellowed Far Side cartoons all over scientists' office doors. And these days, you see XKCD strips all over their Twitter feeds. It's cool. It's why I'm so excited that we're joined here today by the creator of those letters, XKCD, Randall Monroe.
Yes. Mr. Monroe, greetings, Randall. Welcome to the show, man. It's great to see you.
No, thank you for having me.
We'll start with this. The full title of your most recent book, it's How to Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real World Problems. It starts with this quote, "This is a book of bad ideas." Now, why did you think it was a good idea to do a book full of bad ideas?
Well, I didn't start out trying to come up with bad ideas, but I feel like I'm always coming up with bad ideas when I'm just trying to come up with ideas in general. And the tricky thing with ideas is you don't know which ones are good and which ones are bad at first. Sometimes an idea that seems really, like, obviously bad turns out to be really good, and then sometimes vice versa. And I find that the process of, like, taking an idea and exploring it to see how it would go wrong if you tried it, or maybe surprisingly, like, how it would go more right than you think, can be really fun and can teach you a lot.
Taking it to its logical conclusion. That's your business, right? That's your whole point of view.
Yeah, exactly. And it always takes you in some really interesting directions. I had a friend who had ants getting into his house, and he texted me once while I was just walking down the street, and he was like, "Hey, this is your kind of thing. I want to know, can I get a lava moat around my house? I've tried everything else to keep the ants out, but we're surrounded by forest and they just keep getting in. And I think a lava moat could do it, but can I build that?"
A lava moat, molten rock, yeah, encircling, mm-hmm, your residence.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, and maybe it has some practical benefits, but also it sort of fits that, like, budding supervillain aesthetic you might be going for in your home design landscaping.
I can understand the appeal.
Well, and so when I hear that, my first thought is like, okay, that's a terrible idea. Which, I mean, is certainly true. But what I was thinking was, well, that's got to be just unaffordably expensive, right? Because if you want to make lava requires lots of heat. And heat takes a source of energy, and energy is expensive. But then I stop and I'm like, I don't know. Is it unaffordable? How much would it cost to try to keep that much lava hot?
And we're talking about ants. We're trying to keep
right,
ants
so
at
like
bay. You don't need an especially big moat. Just a couple.
But when there's that phase where you've got the flying ones flying around, so maybe you need the updrafts from a large hot lava pool to sweep them away. But what I like is, like, for me, what's really appealing about this kind of thing, and it's the same thing that appeals to me about answering weird science questions, is that, like, once I get a good question like that, like, could you afford to keep a lava moat around your house?
Hang on a second. Once I get a good question like that, I want to put a lava moat around my house to keep away ants.
Okay. Well, a question that has a clear answer, but I can't immediately figure out what it is. But to me, it's like getting a song stuck in your head where you have a question and you're like, I think I could answer that. I think I know how to figure it out, but I'm not sure. It's like I'll drop anything I'm doing and just like, okay, well, wait, maybe if I Google this paper, maybe if I find this thing, okay, I've got to do a calculation. So I actually, when my friend texted me about this, I stopped. I remember I was just walking down the sidewalk and I stopped and I'm like, well, okay, how much heat does lava really put out?
And how much heat does it take?
Know.
What's the thermal capacity of lava rock? Tephra.
Yeah, exactly. Although that's sort of your initial cost. Like, this is going to cost a lot to set up. But then what I was thinking was you're going to need to keep this moat 24/7. Otherwise, what good is it doing you? And so I figured the ongoing costs were going to be the problem.
So what if you live in a volcanically active place? What if this guy decides this is so important to him, he's going to go to Hawaii or New Zealand,
yeah,
or what have you?
Well, and that seems like it would save your costs if you build your house right next to an active lava flow. But then I think the cost of rebuilding your house every so often when the flow got a little bit too high and suddenly covered your house, mm-hmm, might end up costing you more.
Well, don't leave us in suspense. Walk us through the rest of your process. What's the answer? Is it, how much energy does it take for half an ant?
Well, so
lava
I was surprised, you know, I looked up, you know, they do infrared surveys of lava flows, and there are all these models showing how much heat they put out. And so I could figure out a rough estimate of the heat of a moat that's X feet or X meters wide, and then ask my friend how big his property is. And, you know, it depends on exactly how wide you want the moat to be and how big your house is. But in general, the number was sort of in the five figures per day. Now, that's definitely outside of my or
five
my friend's
figures
price
of what?
Range. Like I think like $20,000, $30,000,
$40,000. Mm-hmm. A day.
Yes, per day. And when I saw that, that sort of surprised me because on one hand, it's certainly, you know, outside my or my friend's price range. But it's also sort of less than I expected. Like, that's an amount of money that there are quite a few people out there who could afford to spend that much a day on a lava moat and not even notice it. So if there are any budding supervillains out there, this is sort of surprisingly affordable. I really expected it to be more astronomical.
So how wide was, if I decide to go this route, how wide was the proposed moat?
Well, I think you want it to be more than a meter or so wide. And I actually talked to some volcanologists about this and confirmed if you get a running start, you don't want to sit next to a meter wide lava moat because the heat coming off of it is going to roast you. Yeah. But if you get a running start, I think, someone, a marauder or someone trying to get over your moat, a person with a running start, if they're wearing, you know, heavy protective clothes, could jump over a 1 meter lava moat and spend brief enough time near it that they would, escape without being singed. So I think you want it to be at least a couple of meters wide.
But we're trying to keep away ants. Right.
Yeah. Well, so as with many of these things, my the original question that prompted it just sort of fell by the wayside as I started to think, okay, well, why would you want to build a lava moat? Are there any other reasons I can think of that I'd need a lava moat? Because now I've spent all this time designing one.
So how do you contain a lava moat? Do you have, is there insulation or just you let layers of a layer of rock cool on the walls of the conduit, the gutter of the moat?
Yeah. The real challenge isn't so much containing it and keeping it from melting other things. It's keeping it from solidifying. So the challenge is, what kind of heating elements do you have to keep the lava hot in the moat? You know, hot enough that, like, you could do a lava moat that was like 600 degrees Celsius, and it would there are plenty of molten materials you could have there, but it wouldn't really glow that satisfying yellow color. Mm-hmm. It would work fine for keeping people out, but I feel like it doesn't really count as a lava moat if it's not kind of that red orange.
What kind of depth do you need for the ants? Or will just the heat take care of that?
I mean, I think that the ants probably just like will just see the lava moat, you know, be like, well, in that direction, there's lava. We're going to go bother this other house over here. So maybe it's sort of a deterrent. You do have to look out, though, because there are a couple of species called lava crickets, which are these little invertebrates that, you know, insect-like creatures that live in lava tubes in Hawaii and a few other places like that, where there isn't very much known about them because the environments they inhabit are so hard to like safely explore and observe them in that there just isn't a ton of research.
So one of the most popular Science Guy episodes was about volcanoes. And I ran through lava tubes, and they occur when there's a lava flow and the roof of the flow cools off. And so then it drains away, leaving a hollow space, a cave. So when you have a lava moat to keep the ants away, how do you work with the roof of the lava moat cooling off? You want to maintain that orange glow is what you were saying, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so the real challenge there is to get enough heat coming up through the bottom and like insulate it around it. So the heat is going to only be able to really escape through the top.
So,
and that'll keep it hot, but that's what takes such a big input of power. And you have to have the heating system able to survive the high temperatures. And so there are systems they use in forges and in smelting factories to keep these big open cauldrons of molten metal up at temperatures in the thousands of degrees. And you could adapt one of those.
As much as I'm loving the lava moat in the book of bad ideas, are there bad ideas that end up being good ideas?
Yeah. Well, at one point, I had one chapter where I was thinking about common problems that I've had that are really frustrating. And I did a chapter on how to move. And I figured moving is a huge pain. No one likes moving. And packing up all your stuff is especially, you know, just tedious. And it's a huge amount of physical work and mental work. And I thought, you know, it's instead of putting all my stuff in boxes, my house is already kind of a box. Could I just pick up the house and move it? And I know people move houses sometimes, you know, there are those trucks that they put them on. And so I started thinking, yeah. But then it turns out there are all these permits you have to get, and you have to like get a permit for each jurisdiction you drive through, and you have to, and then I was thinking, what about like, and what if you live next to a bridge, you have to go under the bridge, you know? So then I started thinking, could you lift a house into the air?
Like the movie.
And so I was looking at, yeah, exactly.
That
exactly.
Sounds like a good
and
idea.
So I was thinking, what, you know, could I just go and borrow a helicopter from someone? But I was looking and I discovered that the biggest heavy lift helicopters in the world don't have the capacity. They're like, they have like half the lifting capacity of the kind of house that I grew up to lift the kind of house I grew up in. But then I'm thinking, okay, well that won't work. Except if the helicopter has half the lifting capacity I need, then all I need are two helicopters.
Sure. What could go wrong?
I was thinking, well, you know, you could take two or three helicopters, maybe a third one for safety, and have them all lift the house, like each one pulling in kind of different directions so that they aren't colliding with each other. And then I was thinking, well, how do you keep the helicopters from colliding they're all on the end of strings that are all attached to your house? And I thought, oh, well, you know, there's no reason to have them moving independently. You could just connect the helicopters up with some kind of like a rigid frame. So they're all like locked together into a single mega helicopter.
Well, what exactly. You need yeah, is a yeah. quadcopter
you
of
just
enormous
have some rebar
enormity.
Or 2x4 connecting your helicopters.
Exactly. And I thought, well, why not just take an existing big heavy lift helicopter, get another two or three or four of them, and make a giant quadcopter. And I was surprised to discover not only am I not the first person to have this idea, but in the 70s, a helicopter manufacturer actually produced a design study for the Navy on what they called the multi-helicopter heavy lift system. And their idea was just take two existing helicopters, cut the tail off of one of them, join the nose up to the other one, and then you've got a helicopter with double the capacity. And it's there's this, you can read this 150-page, very serious report laying out all of the technical problems and feasibility
well,
of
the
this
Chinook,
idea.
There
was another one, I don't know if this qualifies as a good idea, but it was another case where I was really surprised that this idea worked better than I would have thought. I did a chapter that was how to deliver a package from space, like if you're in the space station, you want to send down, you know, you want to return your order from some online retailer and you forgot to send it before you got into the spaceship.
Doggone it.
And then NASA's sick of ferrying your Zappos returns back down for you. So you're like, well, I'm looking down at, you know, North America right now where their receiving facility is. Can I just kind of push it out the window, give it a good throw? And I was thinking, well, of course you can't do that because any package or letter that you threw out of the space station would burn up on reentry. And that's mostly true, but it turns out that if you have something that's very kind of thin and flat, like something in a manila envelope, if it can survive up to just a couple hundred degrees Fahrenheit, like sort of typical like baking paper temperatures, it looks like there are some calculations that suggest that as it enters the atmosphere, it'll slow down up high where the air is thin enough and won't ever really reach those super high burning up temperatures. It'll just kind of come to a rest and then gently drift down. And so
it doesn't need a parachute or anything. It's just sort of, it's drag limited.
Yeah. It's only for things that are really thin and lightweight. And this led to another proposal, which again, sadly, they didn't go through with, but it was a proposal by some Japanese researchers to take a bunch of paper airplanes up to the International Space Station and then chuck them out and let them enter the atmosphere. And in theory, according to all these calculations, they should survive the trip down.
How could we have not funded that?
I know,
that?
Right?
Kind of it seems like a very low budget experiment, yeah. Also.
Although it does, it also seems like the sort of thing where even if it's not funded, they probably got some paper up there, right? You know, you could just sort of sneak out a couple of pages of the emergency manual on your spacewalk.
We're talking about these crazy things from space, but you also talk about the NASA Sky Crane, which honestly, if you did not know it was a real thing, you would think that was a classic absurd bad
idea.
Yeah,
I love this, the way that they landed the rover on Mars. That's one of my favorite examples of an idea that it sounded ridiculous even to the people who were working on it. You know, they came up with it and it's like, well, this sounds ridiculous, but we can't think of any better idea and we also can't find a specific problem with this one. The way to get the rover,
except the complexity.
Yeah, exactly. But then all of the ideas that seem better turn out to be more complex and have more unsolvable problems.
Do you want to explain the NASA Sky Crane for those who aren't already familiar?
Sure. The general problem was when NASA wanted to land the Curiosity rover on Mars, they have landed other rovers by surrounding them with airbags. So they'll have a parachute that slows them down partway, but Mars's atmosphere is really thin. So to slow them down at the very end, they'll inflate these airbags that they bounce, let them bounce and roll and come to a stop. But the Curiosity rover was much bigger than any of the other rovers that the US has sent. And the problem was they found that the parachutes couldn't be big enough to slow it down enough in Mars's thin atmosphere for the airbags to be able to absorb the impact. And so what they had to do instead, they were thinking, we have to figure out a way to slow it down more than the airbags and parachutes can slow it down. So they thought, okay, well, can we do some kind of, use a rocket to make it land itself? And they found that the auto-land system, if you put a rocket on the bottom of the rover, as it gets near the ground, it'll start kicking up dust. And the dust will interfere with its ability to see the ground and to orient itself. And that would interfere with its ability to land. And so they tried a bunch of other sensible sounding things, you know, bigger airbags, bigger parachutes, et cetera. But eventually someone came up with this idea that they called the Sky Crane, which was to dangle the robot from a hovering vehicle that would hover high up on rockets, high up enough that it wouldn't kick up any dust. And then it would lower the robot on a winch, like on a downward toward the ground, just dangling there. And then when it made contact with the ground, the Sky Crane would cut itself free. The robot would detach, you know, the rover would detach from the Sky Crane, and the Sky Crane could fly off.
It sounds kind of insane.
Yeah, I mean, it worked so well. And I really liked how NASA, when they, you know, they talked about this, they kind of played that up. The fact that no one has ever done this before, and the fact that it did sound kind of ridiculous. Because so often with space stuff, everyone, you know, is trying so hard to look, you know, make sure that they seem everyone understands they're doing their best. They're very serious, you know, very competent. It can make it seem sort of routine. And I really enjoy when they kind of acknowledge, like, this is a really wild thing we're attempting here.
Stick around for more science rules after this.
When your space has the long-lasting, noticeable scent of Airwick Vibrant Essential Mist, you'll want to invite everyone over. From book club to reality TV watch parties, even the in-laws.
It smells amazing.
Airwick Vibrant Essential Mist is infused with 2 times more essential oil versus regular Airwick Essential Mist for our most authentic, nature-inspired fragrance experience. Airwick Vibrant Essential Mist is perfectly portable and effortlessly easy. The way fragrance should be. Now that's a breath of fresh Airwick.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
Science Rules is back.
Randall, it's so much fun. It's so easy to go down a rabbit hole where you just, okay, what if this adds to this? We're going to have a lava moat for the ants. Okay, when do you stop? When you go down rabbit holes from absurd questions, where do you draw the line? And when you draw the line with stick figures, for crying out loud. So go ahead. Where do you stop? How do you know when you've reached the logical conclusion? Is it when everybody dies, which is popular with you?
Yeah, knowing when to stop is the real trick. A lot of the time it's when I realize it's 3 a.m. and I've been reading about currents in the Earth's outer core and I need to wake up at 8 the next day and, oh no, I have to go to sleep. But yeah, knowing where to cut your losses on exploring these rabbit holes is always tricky. If I go down some rabbit hole and I'm like, well, I'm not really finding questions that have satisfying answers or that have, you know, seem like they have a lot of interesting mystery to them, sometimes I'll back up. But then usually in the course of like exploring down that avenue, I found 3 or 4 other, you know, potential rabbit holes, potential avenues to go down. I mean, like we could spend a whole day just looking into what ways do we have of observing the Earth's outer core and figuring out, okay, that guy said it's unknowable. Is it really? You know, there's got to be a way we can figure it out. The Earth's magnetic field fluctuates because of changes in the outer core. So what do we learn from that? You know, can we... That could go on forever. And, you know, any process will like turn up like 5 or 10 of those. And you sort of have to have some kind of a goal in mind. Like, I'm going to come back out of this with the coolest thing I found and show that off. And so I try to sort of do that.
Now, Randall, I have to interject. Sure. This is a call-in show. And you're talking about the possibility of calculating and getting answers. We have a question here that I think will be ripe for that kind of a process.
Hi, Bill Nye. I'm wondering, what is the perfect radius to be away from Yellowstone when it blows? How far away do I need to be to live?
So this would be the super volcano under Yellowstone National Park. The heat of the earth creates the phreatic, steam-driven, Old Faithful geyser.
The Yellowstone supervolcano is such a fun thing. I always love when people are like, what do you mean the Yellowstone supervolcano? And then it's really exciting because you get to introduce someone new to this idea that there's this giant volcano under Wyoming that hasn't erupted in several 100,000 years, but could erupt at any time in theory. Probably won't. But if it does, I think I would worry less about being close to it and more about being downwind from it. Like, if you get within a certain distance, that's bad because there's a shockwave and, you know, it's going to blast stuff out in all directions. But then when we've had these volcanoes erupt, first that, you know, there's the initial, like right nearby, there's a massive outflowing in all directions. But then as the kind of column of steam and ash and stuff rises up, it gets carried by the winds. And so you'll have ash deposited, all the stuff that blew up out of the ground gets deposited downwind. And so it could be that for 1,000 miles, if the wind, so the wind, you know, if it's coming from the west, then 1,000 miles to the east, there could be huge layers of ash laid down, you know, burying houses and covering fields and stuff.
So this next one is the kind of question that producers love to spring on guests.
Hey, Bill and Corey, I actually have a twofer for you guys. So first of all, I wanted to know, if you fart in a vacuum, can it make a sound? And then the second part of that question would be, if I'm drowning underwater and I fart, can I breathe that fart in for more air? Thank you.
All right, Randall, this sounds like your kind of thing.
No, I would say not really and no, respectively.
So, see, here's what he did. See, everybody, he's got the idea. And now you're going to your intuition about what would happen, and now you're going to pursue it from a science standpoint. Take it.
Well, so the first question about, you know, if you fart in a vacuum, can it make a sound? And so the sound is when you have a gas, a pressure wave moving through it. And so if there's a vacuum, there's nothing to carry the pressure wave, so then there's no sound. But
you could hear the vibration traveling through your own body.
Yeah, but I don't think that counts because you can do that anywhere. Yeah, you would hear it in that sense. What I was thinking was the moment you fart, it's not a vacuum anymore because you're expelling gas.
Right, you can't put gas into that space.
So then you filled the space with gas, and then if you fart a second time,
have you filled the space
that one
with
makes
gas?
A sound.
Are you outside of the space?
If it's a vacuum. Yeah, if it's a vacuum, it's going to expand pretty fast. That's so you'll have a window there where you've got a cloud around you.
I don't think
you
so.
You could conceivably transmit
a sound
through that.
No, I think at human body temperatures, these molecules are going to leave you at the speed of sound. And they're going to take off. Like
yeah,
crazy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was sort of imagining this at first in some kind of like a, you're in a
how about a space suit?
Yeah, or a space, like... I was thinking about like a spaceship where the air is evacuated and you're floating around in it, you know, but yeah.
Okay. So what about the breathing part? Let's get to the breathing part.
Well, so my first thing is I assume no, because I don't know what gases are in.
I don't think there's much oxygen
because all what's happening in your intestines is decomposition and
bacteria are anaerobically breaking down the...
Yeah, I don't think there's oxygen production happening there. Your body's trying to... You're not photosynthesizing. You're not producing oxygen. So if you put out a bunch of gas that has no oxygen in it and you breathe it, it's just going to displace oxygen in your lungs. If it displaces CO2 in your lungs, it could make you feel like you no longer need to breathe. Which is why some of those gases can be so dangerous. Because if you put in something else in place of the CO2, your lungs feel less urgency and you don't realize that you're starting to black out.
God, you just go right down the rabbit hole, man. Just turn up to 11. That's so cool. But you're a physics guy, right? And the old saying, if everything happens for a reason, the reason's usually physics. But you get a lot of questions about energy and astrophysics, right? Is mm-hmm. that because that's what you like?
Yeah.
Or is that the kind of question you get?
It's a little of both. I like reading and writing about space stuff. And I feel like a lot of people then people who are excited about space are, you know, likely to send me questions. And I think there's just something appealing about really big stuff, you know, in the same way that like I've always been a giant fan of the movie Jurassic Park. And it's just, there's something, you know, dinosaurs are just inherently appealing because they're really big.
Space and dinosaurs.
Space and dinosaurs.
In science
yeah.
education, we talk about it all the time. your work has, I guess, what we would call a spirit of generosity. You want people to know this stuff, right?
I think one of your most famous XKCD strips is the one where you talk about, basically, instead of ridiculing people for not knowing things, celebrate the joy of being able to tell them about things like the Mentos and Coke experiment. That if somebody doesn't know about it, don't say, "What? You don't know about it?" You say, "Hey, I'm about to show you something so cool it'll blow your mind."
Yeah, one thing that I've felt when I was doing my my physics degree and learning about this stuff is you end up surrounded by all these really smart people, and they're talking about these things that are really hard to understand. And And it can make anyone feel kind of insecure about, like, do I know enough? Am I smart enough for this? And one of the side effects that can have is it can make you want to prove yourself by not admitting when you don't know something or don't understand something. And then by sometimes when you see that someone else doesn't know something, jumping on them about it and being like, how do you see this person doesn't know about this? How do you not know about this? I know about this. And it's sort of a way, you know, it's, I think it comes out of an insecurity of wanting to reassure yourself that you belong. But the effect it has, you know, reassure yourself, I know what I'm talking about. It's this person who doesn't. But then it has the effect of making them more insecure. And then they're more likely to jump all over you if you don't know something. And it makes everyone just sort of reluctant to share when they don't know something. And then we don't learn stuff from each other.
Right, so it's like a chronic problem of science communication.
Yeah, and so I try to really encourage people to try to check that impulse to make fun of someone when they don't know something, or to look down on them, or make them feel stupid, because you don't teach them to. If you make someone feel bad about not knowing something, it's not like you create an incentive for them to know more things. All you do is teach them to never try to admit to you when they have something they might learn, you know, when there's something they don't know. And then you miss out on getting to tell them about the Yellowstone supervolcano or about the Diet Coke and Mentos thing. And you lose out on all the fun.
And your work is nominally apolitical, right?
I guess. I don't know. I try to do comics about whatever I'm, you know, whatever I have something that I think is really fun or interesting to say about it. You know, so sometimes it touches on political subjects, but...
You know, this whole sort of obsession of, you know, experts and, you know, we don't believe experts, they're talking down to us, they're part of the deep state. It seems very adjacent to the idea that you were just describing of if people feel talked down to, that becomes an impediment to understanding. And I think that's actually become like an active tool of political fighting, is trying, you know, it's cultivating that idea that, oh, the experts are talking down to you. Is there a way to fight back?
It's sort of always good for anyone in any position to try to when they want to talk about something and explain something, to try to do it more clearly, and to, you know, with more sympathy and kindness and stuff. I also think sometimes scientists are busy, and, you know, you can't expect them to be good at this or to be able to do this all the time. You know, which is why, I mean, that's something that's I think really helpful, is having someone in a role like you, Bill, helping to kind of go between the people doing the science and the public and try to make these ideas clear and explain them. And
well, so that's your business too.
Yeah. Well, and so I think that it's good to be able to take a little bit of the load off of scientists, because I just feel really bad for the people who are working on climate change and doing all these like incredibly careful, detailed, you know, projects where I'm going to try to estimate the contribution of the Pacific Decadal Oscillation to the global temperature feedback, you know, system, and I'm going to spend my entire life just trying to nail down this one small component of this as precisely as possible, and then to turn on the TV and see someone saying like, oh yeah, they don't know what they're talking about there. That's got to be frustrating.
Let's go with frustrating, especially in the case of climate change. Now, here's another one for you. We're supposed to send people, the United States is supposed to send people back to the moon by 2024. Do you think that's possible in your add it all up rabbit hole, detailed physics way of thinking?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it's, do we have to bring them back? Sending them one way is a lot easier.
Oh, let's leave it there.
I don't know.
Let's leave them there.
I think with a lot of these things, it's possible. Is it a good idea? I don't really know.
Lava moat to keep ants out is possible. Is it a good idea?
No.
Putting people back on the moon.
Right, that's a strong stance on lava moat.
Putting people back on the moon.
I don't know. I know there's been the back and forth between, you know, should we go to the moon? Should we go to Mars? Should we go to the moon as a stepping stone to Mars? And that's something where it's sort of almost more of a social and political question than a scientific one. You know, we've got the rockets. We can build a rocket. We can try to solve that problem. But like, we need to know which problem we're solving. And I know that you know, your colleague Emily Lakdawala has talked about that kind of seesawing effect, and how she's worried about about just that we keep changing what our goal is every few years, every new administration, whatever, then we'll just never go anywhere at all. I've always been a fan of the moon as a destination, not necessarily for any, you know, particularly scientific reason. What always appealed to me was there's a disappointing thing that I at some point learned, which is that no matter how big wings you make, a person can't use their arms to fly, not in Earth's atmosphere, because we just weigh too much and our arms just don't have the power. And that's really disappointing. And, you know, there are all these myths of people making wings and being able to fly, but it's not going to work. There's just no way around it. Arms aren't strong enough. But if you go up to the moon and you get an oxygen-filled dome or something, then a person could fly around under their own muscle power up there. And a person could, if you had a pool there, you could swim and you could jump out of the water like a dolphin. And I would love to see Olympics with where you send Michael Phelps to the moon and they have like new swimming strokes where they're like leaping out of the, doing skipping like flying fish. I don't know. That
How cool
like there's so
that
much
be?
Cool stuff like that in that low gravity.
Science Rules will be right back.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
Hey, listen. Remember how you told me to toss those takeout containers before we left for vacation? And you were like, I'm serious. If that leaks over the counter, it'll be a slimy abomination by the time I get back. And I was like, yeah, of course. Don't worry about it. I won't forget. Well...
Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed. Rinse after use if in contact with food surface.
You're listening to Science Rules.
Wait, Bill, that sound, it's thunder. Thunder only happens
yes,
when it's lightning.
Yes, the lightning round. Yes, so here's what we're going to do, Randall. We ask you a question, you just come up with an answer quickly, electrically.
Right.
If you could live in the world of any famous comic strip, what would it be?
Oh, there's a lot of them. I've always had a really deep love for Calvin and Hobbes. The long strips where they would just, you know, ride a wagon or a sled down all kinds of landscapes as they argue over something. The backgrounds are always so lush there. I feel like it was really the best comic strip of its generation. And I'd love to walk around those woods.
What is the best what if question you've ever been asked?
There was one, someone asked if they had a bullet with the density of a neutron star and they shot it at the ground, what would happen? And that turned out not to be very interesting, but then I started thinking, what if you left it in the gun or just had it sitting there on a pedestal? Could you touch it?
Or would the Earth just be sucked around it by gravity?
Exactly. Well, and it turns out the Earth wouldn't be sucked around it by gravity, but you could get near it. But it would start pulling. The tidal forces would start pulling on your arm. But it's something where it has unimaginably strong gravity, but it's not totally outside the realm of like physical understanding. So I realized that if you just took a hose and you like sprayed water at this thing, the water would collect around it in a ball. But then when it got far enough away, it would sort of start falling off, and you'd end up with this sort of lava lamp shape of water, just kind of sitting.
Oh God! How
like,
cool
rippling.
Is that? Nicely done.
I know, right? And I just like...
But wait, you require a pedestal that can hold up a slug of neutron.
Yeah, so you're
going to
need some kind of a magic pedestal.
But sure.
But it only needs, you know, the neutron star weighs as much as a city block. The bullet would weigh as much as a city block. But that tells you that you only need a pedestal the size of a city block, because city blocks are held up by those.
So there you go. Have you ever been stumped? Has there ever been a question you can't reason your way to the end?
Oh, absolutely. All the time. There was one that I got where someone asked if they could row a boat on a lake of superfluid helium. And it actually, I said, you know, I don't know. That's a weird quantum question. I don't know the answer to that. And I tried to think about it for a little bit and eventually just gave up and said, no, this is beyond me. And it was a few years later, I was going to visit my old university and I talked to one of my physics professors and I mentioned this question to him. And he was like, "Oh, that's a good question. Let's." And he started thinking about it. And
what goes wrong?
Well, when you get helium, that's
because
super
it's
cool.
Super fluid.
You end up with these with all these weird quantum effects where like there's the effect where it'll like creep up and over the sides of containers and flow, and it does some things that are kind of quantum behaviors, almost like teleportation. And so it's just very hard to intuitively think about, you know, if you don't work through the calculations. But then with the help of the professor, I made some progress.
This is a lightning round. Doggone it. We went down a rabbit hole right there.
Yes. Wait a second. So is the answer yes or no?
You could for a little bit.
Done.
All right. If you could be doing anything else with your life, what would it be?
Oh, man. I don't know.
I'd work on antennas. If everything were different and I stayed an engineer, I would have worked on...
Wait, what kind of antennas?
Big, small, whatever. Cell phone, watch satellites, look for asteroids. I just think the mechanical thing with the invisible field is just cool as heck. That's me, though. Uh-huh. All right. What's your favorite field of science?
Ooh, I'm a big fan of anything involving time.
Horology.
But, you know, really, this is... Oh, yeah, that's a good word. I've always really liked any kind of math, but probability, the whole idea of uncertainty, you know, it comes up all over the place in science whenever you have like a sort of weird statistics idea, you know, or you need to analyze some data. I've always really, really enjoyed any problem that involves probability because there are such simple questions like balls in a jar that you're going to draw out, but you can really quickly get to kind of unsolvable conundrums from very simple
pieces. Speaking of which, what is the least understood field of science? Not just the unknowable,
I don't know.
Which field of science that we know the least about?
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure that the deeper you go in any field, the more you realize, oh, hey, here's a thing this field doesn't actually understand. Like in physics, I always enjoy the things where I feel like I know a lot, you know, about compared to other fields. You know, I know a lot about physics since that's what I did a degree in. But then it makes me very aware of the simple questions that physics can't answer, like why lightning happens. We're not sure.
We're in the lightning round. We don't know why there's a lightning round.
Wow, just a minute. Like okay, what if we had a president who was a scientist? Would the world be better or would it be a mess?
I mean, I like to say that'll be better, but I don't know. I think that being president, you can talk to a lot of scientists and get their help. I think that being a president who's good at enlisting the help of scientists might be a better approach there because if my friends are any indication, scientists have trouble not going down those rabbit holes sometimes.
Plus, it's a different skill.
I feel like the president needs to focus on a lot of different things.
Especially personal relationship. Now, this is one you've heard about many, many times. This is a Facebook comment. What if the theory about reality as we know it being only a computer simulation is proven to be true? Like, how would this change our lives and society? Like, could we be living in a simulation, man?
Even though it was a Facebook question, he asked it in that voice.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
I don't know. I feel like people bring up the simulation thing whenever something sort of weird or unexpected happens. And I've never been sure what to make of that exactly. Like, oh, the Chicago Cubs won the World Series. We are clearly living in a simulation. But like,
clearly,
are the people running the simulation really interested in the Chicago Cubs?
And like, then the other idea that's so troubling here? Is your memories have been put there. You have no ideas of your own. They've only the memory of everything that's happened to you has been put there. So we have a saying in science, Zach, out there. You can't prove a negative. You cannot have a hypothesis that has no way to be proven wrong.
The premise of the question said, like, what if it was proven? And that was the thing that caught my attention, because what if it was proven we lived in a simulation? Okay, I'm excited. I'm interested in how that was proven. Did we find a note?
That's the interesting part.
Did we look at space and see a note from the simulation makers that are like, you are in simulation so-and-so of... Like, okay, is this note just to us? It's in English. Are there other planets with life? Are they in the same simulation?
Or is it the screeching obelisk?
Right. Is it just
from 2001?
Yeah, exactly. Is it written in every language? Yeah.
Let me know how we proved it, and then I have a whole bunch more questions. I want to know more about the simulation.
Okay, Randall, I have to ask you one pet question of mine. If you could blow up the moon, would you?
No, I like the moon.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay.
Let me ask you this, though. Why did you write this book?
I like showing people how, like, the tools of science can take questions that seem unanswerable and ideas that seem like, well, who knows if that would work, and actually let us answer them, even if they are kind of ridiculous questions. Because I feel like a lot of the time when I would be learning science, sometimes I get deep in some theoretical concept and I'm working through these equations. But like I would always have a lot of trouble focusing if I didn't know why I wanted to know this. Like, what is this for? What does this idea do? So I always liked tying things back to real life problems. And so one of the fun things here is showing that even if your question is ridiculous, you can apply these tools and get an answer to it. And maybe the answer will be something surprising or helpful, but even if it's not, it's going to be something fun.
And it was an exercise, and it engages people who might not otherwise be doing science for a living full time. This has just been cool. Thank you so much, Randall.
Well, thank you so much.
Our guest today has been Randall Monroe, creator of the XKCD comic and author of the books What If?, Thing Explainer, and most recently, How To. Thank you again, Randall, for joining us today to talk about visualizing science for non-experts. And Corey, remember, when it comes to the absurd What If? Part of science,
science rules.
Science Rules is produced by Harry Huggins and our very own Corey S. Powell. Casey Holford mixed this episode and composed our original theme. Josephine Martorana is our executive producer. Chris Bannon is the chief content officer here at Stitcher. And at Stitcher, Corey,
Science Rules.
Stitcher. Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
Hey, listen. Remember how you told me to toss those takeout containers before we left for vacation? And you were like, I'm serious. If that leaks over the counter, it'll be a slimy abomination by the time I get back. And I was like, yeah. Of course. Don't worry about it. I won't forget. Well...
Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed. Rinse after use if in contact with food surface.